And I think tonight is the final episode, the finale of the Four Noble Truths. And so I have the fourth noble truth. And I don't know if you've all been to all of them or any of them, but I'll do my piece to present this teaching. How's the sound? Is this okay? So is there anyone here who hasn't gotten teachings on the Eightfold Path? Okay. All right. So I may have a chance to get some audience, do a little quiz for the audience since you've had teachings. So obviously, I'll do a brief recap of the Four Noble Truths. The first one is that there is suffering that comes with this life, a kind of fundamental dissatisfaction, that there is a cause to that. That's number two. That there is it is actually possible to be released from that. That's number three. And number four, there are suggestions, guidelines. There's a path to help you do that. I guess the formal title of this talk is The Journey to Awakening, Walking the Eightfold Path. So I'm going to start with one of my favorite Chinese proverbs, which you may be familiar with, which is, if you don't change your direction, you will end up where you're headed. If you don't change your direction, you will end up where you're headed. So I think this is a good place to start, and with the question of where are you headed? Where are you headed? Are you going in the direction you would like to be going? And what direction are some of your habits taking you? In what direction are your thought patterns or distractions or behaviors taking you? In what direction are your reactions taking you? Toward more anxiety? Is it taking the direction of stress? Direction of anger or depression? Conflict? Isolation? Fear? Or are they taking you toward greater love? Is that the direction you're going in? More joy, peace, contentment, ease, openness, connection, clarity? Okay, I sort of laid out two directions. Which one appeals to you? So the point is that we are determining our direction moment by moment, every day. And knowing what direction we're going and knowing where it's taking us is what one of my teachers calls the kindergarten of wisdom. Being able to choose your direction, to know what's leading to what's good and wholesome and helpful, and to know what's leading to conflict and suffering and difficulty. It's the very fundamental ground of wisdom. And yet, actually, I find that if you really ask people, they know. Almost everyone knows which is the path to one and which is the path to other, but somehow people often don't choose it or aren't aware that they aren't choosing it, or out of habit or confusion are choosing the directions they don't want to go. And then another way of talking about this is in this tradition, in the Buddhist tradition, We talk a lot about, you probably noticed, practice. Practice, you know, you should practice, more practice, let's all practice, what's your practice? And it goes on and on. Well, one thing I like to say is that in reality, we're always practicing something. We're always practicing something. Maybe not what we're intending to practice. not maybe what we wish we were practicing, not maybe what we're even aware of practicing. But we're practicing something, we're repeating, we're reinforcing something, some many things every day. My father was, he practiced anxiety. And he got very good at it. And by the time he was 90, he was very anxious. And so many of us might be practicing irritation. Perhaps we're practicing distraction. Perhaps we're practicing shutting down. Perhaps we're practicing impatience, at least some of the time. So we're always actively reinforcing thoughts, behaviors, responses, patterns of different kinds. So the Eightfold Path gives us some guidance and some indication of perhaps what is the helpful way to practice. So tonight I'll say a few things about the importance of finding and walking a path. I'm going to offer another metaphor related to that, and then I'm going to unpack the Eightfold Path a little bit and then say a little bit about going beyond the path and maybe some time for Q&A. That's kind of the, we'll see what we actually get to. So I want to say for me, just I don't know if you recall when you first learned about a spiritual path or the Buddhist path, it might be some other path. But I remember in my early 20s when I discovered the Buddhist path, it was actually just discovering that there was a path to take, that there was a journey that I could go on. And just that was a complete revelation. And just that was astonishing to me, that there were these teachings and these methods, and discover that they seemed to be helpful, and people had been doing them for a couple thousand years, and they'd been passed down from person to person. And that there were other people out there interested in that, and that people actually were talking about and learning and studying about the things that I felt were so important and yet didn't seem to be addressed in my youth and my education. I sort of take it for granted now, which is a little unfortunate, and you may take it for granted that there's a path and there's things we can do in the path. But I'm going to encourage you to not take it for granted. To take the availability of a path that has clear instructions and guidance that you can engage yourself with. I was amazed that there is this whole way of learning, of growing and understanding, of a kind of inner evolution possible, tapping into some innate potential, again, that no one before had ever told me about. That I wasn't just stuck for the rest of my life with my various neuroses and thought patterns and ways of looking things, the negativity and the constant self-judgment. That there was a way out of this fog of confusion and pain and fear. Not an easy way, not a short way, but a way. And I remember just the elation that maybe a life of purpose and meaning was actually possible. So the Buddha, you may have heard this. I always like this story, or this metaphor that the Buddha used. The Buddha described what happened to him on the night of his enlightenment as discovering an old ancient path in the forest, in the jungle. An old ancient path that leads to a marvelous hidden place, previously hidden. and that a place, a path that had been walked many times before but had since been forgotten, had been kind of lost to common knowledge, that was now overgrown with plants and had sort of disappeared from view. But he, on the night of his enlightenment, had rediscovered this path. He didn't create the path. He didn't, it wasn't his idea, per se, but he rediscovered it and began walking it again and also began offering directions and guidance to us about where we find it, how we walk it, and where it takes us. This, of course, this kind of metaphor is common in myths throughout the world. This is perhaps one of the myths that bind us or connect us all as humans. And it's certainly Joseph Campbell, you may be familiar with, talked about it, the hero's journey, this idea that we are impelled to go on a search and we leave behind the known for the unknown, that we meet challenges and difficulties, and from that we grow and we learn and we eventually return to who we are, return home in some way. And of course, we find that it's not necessarily a leaving, a physical leaving, but it is a leaving behind what we have been conditioned to believe, perhaps. It is a leaving behind what we have been taught to believe, perhaps. It is a leaving behind the habits and the ways of doing things that we just do them because that's what we think we're supposed to do. And life comes with difficulties and challenges whether we're on a path, a conscious path or not. But once we're on the path, then all those challenges and difficulties become very rich opportunities. That's one of the main differences I find from people who are on an authentic spiritual path and people who are not. People who are not are confounded and confused and often, we're all confounded and confused some of the time, but are often when the challenges and difficulties of life come up, it's like there's something wrong, this shouldn't be happening. There's less likely to be an embracing and a learning from the experience. But when you're on an authentic spiritual path, these are, if not welcomed, they're at least understood to be part of the path. They're understood to be an opportunity for us to deepen, to let go, to discover more parts of ourselves or the world. So this is, I just happened to be looking at Joseph Campbell's stuff today. It is important, I just want to say, it is important that we find a path and we try to walk that path, whether it's this one or another one. And Joseph Campbell said, one way or another, we all have to find what best fosters the flowering of our humanity in this contemporary life and dedicate ourselves to that. So this is just kind of a pep talk about the Eightfold Path. Because again, we can get used to it, we've heard about it, we kind of are, you know, walking along as best we can. But I think it's important to enliven this journey. I want to share another way of thinking about this, that through another metaphor, that actually in some ways for me is even a little more accurate than walking on a path or taking a journey. When I was leaving, this is a number of years ago, when I was leaving for a month-long solo retreat in the wilderness in Colorado, my teacher said, Practice like you're tending a beautiful garden. He said, practice like you're tending a beautiful garden. At that time, I was a very dedicated organic vegetable grower. And I had an enormous, this is in Massachusetts, I had an enormous garden. And so when he said this, it really resonated to me. I knew what that meant. And the Eightfold Path, in some ways, gives us the skills and techniques for tending this inner garden that we have. And like a garden, we can own this path of awakening. We can't make awakening happen. The only thing we do, and the whole nature of our practice, is to create the best conditions, provide the nourishment, remove obstacles, to allow the awakening to naturally occur. And that, why I like this metaphor, is I find most people in the West, in our culture, subculture, have this idea of if I just work hard enough, if I do it right, step by step, I will get there. I will be the cause. I will make it happen. I will be able to create awakening. And that isn't how it happens. Awakening is coming from something much bigger and beyond our individual personalities. We could say it's a force, a potential. It's the basic nature of life, maybe, the nature of consciousness itself, the nature of nature. And so when we tend a garden, we tend our inner garden, we're carefully, tenderly creating the conditions that will allow this to happen, that will invite this naturalness to come forward, to be revealed to us. Like the seeds that we can't see in the garden eventually will be revealed to us if we give it what it needs. You may have heard this expression. This is also one of my favorites. Came from a Zen teacher. Enlightenment is an accident, and meditation makes us accident prone. So we're making ourselves enlightenment prone. We're making ourselves liberation prone. We're making ourselves awakening prone. And in the same way, you can't make plants grow. The growing is a natural force beyond you. And if you pull on the leaves and tell it to grow faster, it won't, and you may even damage it. And if you demand that it blossom now and fruit now, that will be of little help. If you criticize it for not being big enough, that will also not be of much help. But you can adapt and learn as a gardener, and you can give the plants the best chance that they have to find what helps them thrive and blossom and fruit. And you can tenderly nurture those sprouts of wisdom when they show themselves now and then. And you can learn what seeds to plant. And that's a lot of what the Buddhist path is. What seeds are you planting? So we're creating the conditions for an innate natural process to unfold that's been covered over by layers of trauma, contraction, confusion, delusion, reaction, and so forth. You could say also a Dharma teacher is a kind of master gardener. Suggest you maybe a little more water over there and a little more mulch over there and spend a little more time working with the weeds and maybe dump some manure on there too. And the master gardener can teach you patience and give you encouragement when all you see is dirt and no plants at all. And they can tell you, don't worry, something is happening. You don't see it yet, but something is happening. And your efforts will pay off. So unless we create these optimal conditions for awakening, we're going to continue to be lost in our old habits and our patterns, and will keep us stuck and unhappy. So what is, let's say more about specifically about the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path is not a ladder. It's not really linear, sequential, and progressive. It's usually given in a particular order, but that's not exactly how it operates. And in the tradition, it's shown as eight spokes on a wheel, which is a much better representation. The wheel can't really function unless all eight are there. So this is where you come in. Let's see if this group can let me know what are the eight of the Eightfold Path. Yes?
Generosity?
No, that's actually one of the paramis. But that's a good one. Yeah. Yeah, Jennifer?
Right view.
Right view? Yep, I'm going to just... That's sometimes called right or wise understanding. I usually use view. I like that. What else?
Intention.
Intention. Yeah. What else?
Speech.
Action. Effort, you said? Somebody said effort. And
livelihood.
Yes. Okay, we're missing two important ones.
Mindfulness.
And its companion.
Concentration.
All right, you all get A's. So there are a million talks out there on Dharma Seed and Audio Dharma about each one of these on the Eightfold Path. I'm going to mention each one, but you may have gotten this teaching as well, but the Eightfold Path can be condensed into the Threefold Path. And I really like this condensation, this simplification in a way. It's important to remember all eight, but there's two sets of three and one set of two. So the first one is the wisdom subset. The wisdom, and that includes wise view and wise intention, or right view or right intention. So these two are inviting you to find your clarity of purpose and direction and possibility, getting clear of what are you doing and why, essentially. Why are you doing this? Understanding what your deepest intention is, not your habitual intentions. And most of this comes from experience, practice, of course, but a lot of this comes from exposure to teachings, to study. It comes from self-reflection. So to begin the path, we must have an understanding of basic wisdom. And I already gave you one definition of the kindergarten of wisdom, is the beginning understanding of things that lead to the end of suffering and things that lead to more suffering. So this is sort of the basic wisdom we want to at least start out with. And we need to then, through wise view and wise intention, continually realign ourselves with our deepest intention, with what we know to be most true. And so this is so if you just think about that in your daily life, coming back to what we know is most true, coming back to what is my purpose? What am I doing here? Why am I doing this? What is this for? The next set is I call it integrity. The Pali word is sila. It's sometimes translated as ethics, but there are a lot of people that say integrity is the best translation. So this subset in the threefold path includes wise, a right action, livelihood, and speech. And this means really paying close attention to our behavior and what we're doing and its impact on the world around us. And being congruent with our deepest values. And this both lessens our suffering, if we're, and it also creates the conditions, as I talked about earlier, that support a deep inner opening and insight. So we have to integrate our wisdom and our understanding of the wisdom of non-harming into our actions throughout the day. So, and I think sometimes people are like, well, what does wise livelihood have to do with this, or right livelihood? Why was that picked out? Well, one thing I do is, a way I think about wise livelihood is that I think of it as is how do you spend your resources and time? How do you spend your resources and time? And are they in alignment with your deepest understanding and your deepest intention? What do you support by your livelihood or your activities or what you are engaged in throughout the day, how you spend your time? Is it in support of awakening? Is it creating conditions for yourself and others, for the world? And then I think it's interesting that speech was chosen as one of these eight. It's of all the precepts, and all the precepts are included in wise action, by the way, and hopefully you're familiar with what the precepts are. But speech is highlighted here, which I think can be very useful to all of us. And I think this comes from the fact that so much of our difficulty, our conflict, our confusion, the harm we create, the distractions we have, come from our speech and how we relate to others and how we engage with others. So we have this second area, this area of integrity. And how do we live with integrity? And how that contributes to creating an inner peacefulness. It begins to unwind the inner conflicts that we have and also creates better relationships with others. And then the last of the threefold path is what I call, it's called samadhi is the Pali word, but I call it the heart-mind training. We need to actually train. We need to train in this, and this is what I find in some traditions, there really isn't a training, and yet we need to train because we've already been trained, and as I said earlier, we've been trained in being hyperactive, we've been trained to be overbusy, we've been trained to be very distractible, we've been trained to be defensive, we've been trained to not pay attention. So we need to compensate for that conditioning and that training by the training of mindfulness, concentration, and then wise effort. We need to interrupt actively our habits and patterns. We need to interrupt them many, many times a day. We need to break ourselves out of the trance of our old conditioning, break ourselves out of the trance of all the ways modern life puts us into a kind of stupor. And we need to do this with consistency and continuity, with wakefulness and clarity, and with kindness and gentleness. You can try to You can train, and that's why we have wise effort, because you can do all of this with a kind of effort that is harsh, that is over-demanding, that is critical, that is perfectionist, that is too tight. Of course, you can also have an effort that's a little loose and undefined. But our practice, if you're really interested in awakening, and I hope you are, not just interested in feeling 10% better, not just interested in self-improvement, but I hope you're here because you are truly interested in this phenomenal human potential that we all have, which is actually our deepest nature of being awake and free and present and loving. And this doesn't, as you've noticed, this doesn't happen overnight. And this is a lifelong journey. And in the Buddhist tradition, it's a many lifelong journey. And this idea of our training, our heart-mind training, our being able to begin to melt all the ways that we've encased our hearts and defended our heart. It's like if you want, a pot to boil, you don't keep turning the flame on and off, on and off, on and off. You have to keep the flame going. You don't have to have it on full, but you have to keep it on. And what I see people in their practice is they turn it on for a while and then they turn it off and they turn it on. And by practice, I don't mean sitting on the cushion necessarily, or the chair. That's part of it. But I mean this practice of being present, this practice of collecting the mind and heart, this practice of composing ourselves, of connecting to ourselves and others. So, in the last little bit, and there'll be an opportunity for maybe if there's any questions or comments, so having said all this about this path and walking this path and and doing this for this process of awakening to happen, I want to just say I have a few comments about the pathless path. Because all of that, which I'm promoting, obviously, that I just said, and I'm encouraging, and I'm wanting to inspire you in, can also eventually keep you from seeing the deepest truths and keep you from opening to the fullness of the reality that is now. Because if you keep thinking you have to do something else or be better or keep accomplishing, there'll be a point at which that interferes with you doing the most profound opening to what is. And it's at that point that real awakening begins to take hold. So we learn that we're not actually journeying anywhere, that there's really not anywhere else to be, that there's actually no one else to be, that this is not about self-improvement. We will improve, but that's just a nice side effect. It's not about self-improvement. But you could say it's about returning home to who we are. It's about finally recognizing and coming to rest in who and what we really are and what we have always been. And Ajahn Chah called this our real home, finding our real home, which is right here. And Dogen said, truth is not far away. It is nearer than near. There is no need to attain it. since not one of your steps has led away from it. And finally, the last way I like to maybe think of this is it's simply coming together like this, practicing together, studying together, going on retreat together, sharing together, having discussions together, reading books together, is the way that we, to borrow from Ram Dass, is the way that we walk each other home, to this real home, to this real experience of the freedom and of the love and of the beingness that is beyond the personality, that is beyond good and bad, that is beyond all our ideas and concepts. And we need each other to do this walking to home. And another Joseph Campbell life has no meaning. Each of us has meaning and we bring it to life. It is a waste to be asking the question, what has meaning, when you are the answer.